Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I am joined with Matthew Check, and he is not a new voice on Energy in Action. And just a few months ago, he introduced himself and shared with our listeners his struggles and many of his accomplishments, more accomplishments than struggles, right? He's currently in school working toward a bachelor's in allied health. He's had the opportunity to take a class called The Psychosocial Impact of Disability and Illness. He made it clear to me from our first conversations that he has learned a lot and he had quite a bit to share with our Mito community. So I, for one, am really curious about the class and I wish I could take it myself. I feel like my hand would be raised the entire time I was there. I'm really looking forward to having him share some of what he has learned with all of us. Welcome back, Matthew.
It's nice to be back.
Awesome. So this is a really unique concept, and I want our listeners to know that this episode idea was actually Matthew's. He is so creative and he is so positive, and I absolutely love his energy. So this is his second time on the podcast, and my guess is it will not be the last either. But I am just hoping that you can introduce yourself for a moment. If for some reason there are some listeners that hadn't listened to your first episode, just introduce yourself.
Yeah. So my name's Matthew Check. I'm 21 years old. I live all the way in upstate New York. And right now I'm pursuing a career in healthcare. And because of my own experiences with my mitochondrial disorder, I've just been interested in healthcare and really affected by all the people that have influenced me that I want to give back to that community as much as I possibly can with my limitations.
Well, I think you're doing a really great job. And I think that any community that you work in is going to be very lucky to have you. So again, just as a reminder, Matthew didn't teach this class. He has been a student in this class. He is qualified to share what he has learned in this casual environment in our podcast. But for more specific info in your state and based on your condition, please consult an attorney or a physician. So we are just going to be talking about some of the more higher level things that he's learned. And I think it'll be information that can really benefit all of us. But let's also recognize what we're doing here. So, fill us in a little bit more at a high level about what the class is about.
Yeah, so this class is part of my allied health degree. It's actually an elective that I chose to do because it's my final semester right now. And you have these advanced electives, and I wanted to really, since it's my last semester, I wanted to just kind of have fun with the class. I've taken all the classes that I've need for my bachelor's. So this was just like a fun class. I scrolled through the catalog. I was like, oh, I have experiences with disability. I would like to learn more, see what this class has to offer. And I'm glad that I did, because it really surprised me with how much history that I did not know about the people's lives with disabilities. So the main part of this class is the psychological coping strategies that may be used by individuals with disabilities and their families, which I think is an important aspect. It also looks at the personal and societal factors that impact the disability experience, like gender, race, culture, and socioeconomic status. And it also is exploring the changing societal views and the intersectionality of disability and illness, which I think is an interesting concept, because there's a lot of cross-section between disability and illness, and I really think it's up to the individual to determine for themselves, because I view it as you have an illness and your disability is, I should say, illness causes disability. Disability is how it affects your life, and I think it's interesting. I've heard people say that people with diabetes, I see it a lot, where they say, I don't see myself as disabled, but they have the diabetes, which is an illness, but they don't see themselves as disability. So I think that's an interesting concept that everybody can determine for themselves. And the other major aspect, the first module of this class was on the entire history of disability in America and throughout the world, actually, and how people were treated throughout history.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I feel like, especially within the podcast, we talk a lot about what's happening to us today, but we all know that the treatment was very different, historically speaking. So I almost don't know, like, peeling back the curtain to what it was like, especially for me and you and, you know, those listening who do have disabilities, like, it's kind of tough to hear, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even with all the struggles that we have today, it shies in comparison to the quality of life that someone with a disability had, even, I would say, 60 or 70 years ago. Like, it is not a recent change in society, because I don't think it's a shock that to hear that people with disabilities have been treated as less than human throughout history. Hundreds of years ago, there was no scientific innovation in terms of what disability and illness actually was. So without that scientific knowledge, it led to people imposing their cultural and religious beliefs on why someone is disabled. Like, some cultures thought it was a curse that one of their family members, or something they did in their life to have a family member that was disabled. And that led to people being used as entertainment. Like, they were used as jesters, and they were even put in something called idiot cages, where they were put in the town square and people would just walk by and watch them. And they were used as free labor too, because they had no rights to self-advocate for themselves. So they were just forced to do whatever and no payment. But as time went on with, like, the Renaissance and the Awakening, like, all these scientific studies came out and people actually started to understand what it was like for people with disabilities. And it actually wasn't until the late 1900s, the start of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, that societal views in the treatment of people with disabilities actually began to truly improve.
So the disability rights movement, did that kind of run simultaneously with the Civil Rights Movement?
Yeah. So one of the first assignments in my class was to watch a documentary called Crip Camp. And it came out on Netflix in 2020, and I highly recommend anybody watch that, because that's where a lot of the information and the resources that I've learned have come from, that documentary. So it actually starts off with, a camp in New York called Camp Jened. And it was a camp operated from 1951 to 1973. And it was the first camp that was solely for children and teens with disabilities. And I think that the highlight of the part of the documentary that talks about the camp was the sense of community, that all these people came together with disabilities and just had a fun time regardless of their limitations. And the interesting thing was, none of the counselors had any experience with dealing with people with disabilities. They even describe it as like a bunch of hippies. They just got together and tried to do their best. And one thing I want to mention is the director of the documentary, who was also a camper at the camp, Jened, he actually mentioned how it was actually a culture shock to him, because growing up in a town where he was the only disabled person, being around so many people with disabilities was actually hard for him to adjust to.
Wow.
Because it was just not something he was used to.
Huh.
And like you said, the camp operated around the same time as the Civil Rights Movement. So people were very alert to the issues facing minorities, including people with disabilities. And in the documentary, they say how they would go for field trips And it would be extremely difficult because none of the public spaces were accessible to anybody in a wheelchair or using any mobility aid. And I should also mention that the Camp Jened was the precursor for something called the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, which was created by Paul Newman, the actor. And he was so passionate about children with disabilities that he created over 30 camps across the United States that were basically a higher budget Camp Jened, because Camp Jened was just, they had a few cabins, they had a few like mess halls. It wasn't a big facility, but then Paul Newman, he has a lot of money and he actually did something good with it. He funded all these camps, and one of the camps that he funded, created in 1993, is the one that I go to and I've gone to for 10 years now.
Oh my gosh.
So it's like when I watched this documentary, I related so much to the experience of going to a camp for kids with disabilities. And it was just like, oh my God, I cannot believe that. The biggest shock to me was I've spent 18 years with a disability. I've gone to this camp for 10 years and I've never heard of this Camp Jened before and how it created or how it fueled the disability rights movement.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and to think that like your camp was so directly connected to a surge in, you know, recognizing and acknowledging, mm-hmm. creating space for those with disabilities, that has to feel good, right?
Yeah, I almost started crying when I saw like all the camp, because I was like, oh my God, this is my experience, but like 50 years ago. I'm like, it's the same. It's fundamentally the same culture, just updated to present day.
I guess moving right along, when it comes to the history, you learned about Judy Heumann and the Rehabilitation Act of 1972. So that's a pretty specific act and person, but I want to know why you felt this was important to share with all of us.
Yeah, so Judy Heumann was a camper turned counselor at Camp Jened. She started as a camper there and came back as a counselor, which is actually something, because I recently graduated from my camp, which is something that I think I might do eventually, come back as a counselor. And I would never leave that place forever. It's amazing. And so Judy Heumann, she actually became disabled and required the use of a wheelchair after contracting polio. So it's actually interesting. She had an acquired disability rather than a genetic, or she was born with it. And she was regarded as, quote, the mother of the disability rights movement, similar to like Martin Luther King is the head. She was the head of this movement because she advocated for decades. I believe she passed away in 2023, and she advocated from this 1970s camp all the way until her death. And what many people might not know is, a lot of people know with disabilities, the 504. The 504 plan in schools allows you to get accommodations. Well, that actually wasn't a thing before 1972. The Rehabilitation Act was an expansion of something called the Smith-Fess Act, which allowed federal vocational grants for people with disabilities. The expansion, which would later become 504, included broad anti-discrimination language based on disability status. So what this meant is it would force any organization that is receiving federal funding to not discriminate based on disability. This would be something like public train station having elevators and ramps, because you wouldn't be able to use public transportation if you had a wheelchair at this time. And the act passed the House and the Senate, which meant it went to the president. And the president at the time, Nixon, he vetoed it after it already passed because he was concerned with the budget concerns. He thought that this act would spend too much money on disabled people and it wasn't worth it. And there was the sentiment that would the number of people who benefit this really outweigh the cost? And I think that's really symbolic of how they thought of disabled people. They're like, well, do they really need this? Or do we need to put this much effort into people that are so little. Like it's dehumanizing at that point to not spend that money for that. So back to Judy Heumann, she had a rights group after she became a counselor. She had a civil rights group called Disabled in Action. And after Nixon vetoed the bill, she got a massive protest of all her members and people with disabilities to protest outside of the Nixon offices in Manhattan, and they completely blocked traffic. It was a big intersection in Manhattan, downtown Manhattan, and they blocked all the traffic and caught, like, I think they had police called because these cars couldn't get anywhere because they were completely blocking the road. Just like that, after more protests, they actually did some modifications to the act, and it was passed, and Nixon signed it into law in 1973. So now you have this 504 section that supposedly protects against discrimination, but it was actually not being enforced at all. Part of the people that were affected by it was schools and hospitals because they received federal money. They just didn't want to spend the money because they had to upgrade their buildings now. They had to add ramps, add elevators. They didn't want to do it. And nothing was happening to them. They were not getting punished. They were not getting told to do it. There was just nothing at that point.
So then does that lead to the sit-in?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so this is a real history lesson, and it's one that is so important for all of us to really understand. I mean, I still don't feel understood in my everyday life. I can't imagine
what it was like, you know, back then.
Yeah, and how recent all of this stuff mm-hmm. is that we're talking about. It's really crazy. So teach us more.
So a few years after that, from the time it was passed in 1973 to 1977, these were when the concerns about the enforcement was happening. Nobody was enforcing it. So Judy Heumann decided to organize another protest, and this time it was at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare building in San Francisco.
Okay.
So a group, I think it was about 20 people of her group, went into the office and just decided to sit in. They had signs, they were voicing their concerns about the enforcement, and it started to become nighttime. And so they took a vote to spend the night, despite none of them ever being prepared to do so. And what turned into one night turned into another and another, and they just stayed there for as long as they possibly could.
And these are people with disabilities.
With disabilities,
that need
wheelchairs and all this stuff.
Yeah, good for them.
Yeah, it's insane. And they, of course, the officials and the police didn't like them being in this building. So mm-hmm. they tried to force them out by any way they could. They turned off the hot water, they cut the phone lines, and they actually delayed medical treatment, which was crucial to these people. And I should say, as the days went on, the numbers just grew. It ended up being over 150 disabled protesters in this building. It was all the same floor because it was a multi-floor building. The mm-hmm. office was only on the one floor. And they came together and worked as a team to sustain themselves as long as they needed. One of the highlights in that documentary is there was no phones, and this was way before any other communication technology. So they would have people that knew sign language to sign out the window to somebody else on the floor, on the outside, that knew sign language to communicate what they needed. And they'd got in contact with some nurses that volunteered to come in and bathe anyone that needed it. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah. And they even had.
How long did they stay?
I believe it ended up being almost a month, like 25 to 30 days was in that protest. And they even had one of the civil rights groups in San Francisco, the Black Panthers. They would bring them hot meals every single day. They would leave snacks and they would bring freshly made hot meals every day. And I think this just like I said with the camp, there were multiple protesters that came out and said that this was just like being back at camp, because many of the protesters were at Camp Jened. They they went with Judy Heumann and her group wherever they protested, and there was video of them like singing camp cheers and doing activities. Like it wasn't like a violent event. It was community trying to uplift the silent members of the community that couldn't advocate for themselves. So during the middle of this protest, Judy left and she was able to voice herself in front of two congressmen. And she was the most like incredible public speaker I've ever seen. They show her in the documentary, they show her entire speech to this person. And my favorite moment was the congressmen. She's voicing her concerns and the congressmen are just nodding their head like they're agreeing and like they're actually going to do something. And she looks at them and she says, quote, "I would appreciate it if you would stop shaking your head in agreement when I don't think you understand what we are talking about." Because she was just fed up in these people saying like, oh yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and not doing anything about it because they don't think that people with disabilities are actually like going to do anything about it. Like they're going to fight back or do anything. And after a month of protesting, they were actually starting to see results because coincidentally, there was a broadcast news technician strike at the same time that this was happening. So back then, it was hard. I don't know the exact logistics of this, but when they were covering the news, you actually had to like mail back recorded footage. It wasn't like live streamed across the world. So these technicians were on strike. So none of these news channels were getting news. And there was a journalist named Evan White who covered all the protests and the sit-ins and all these events. And he shipped them off to the news companies. And that was the only thing playing. That was the only news they were getting because he wasn't on strike. And it played all over. So the government, they didn't care when it was only being seen in San Francisco on the local news. But when it goes all over the nation, they start to feel the pressure. And the whole country is aware of what they're doing and what they're fighting for now. So after that, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, which is the building that they're in, his name was Joe Califano. He, out of nowhere, just signed the law that would enforce Section 504. And it was just like the biggest day of celebration for these protesters that, out of nowhere, because of this coverage, they got what they wanted. It's insane.
So what are some of the really big things that happened after because of this?
Yeah, so they, after this win, they're like, oh my gosh, we won, we got this. But the thing with a law is it can be repealed at any time with enough support. So President Reagan was not too happy about how much money was being used for accessibility. And he said something along the lines of, we're mortgaging our children's future for the temporary convenience of the present. So he called having accessible spaces and basically ensuring that disabled people had the right to exist in life and function, he called it a temporary convenience.
The word temporary or convenience, they both seem very inappropriate.
Yeah, it's not a convenience. Mm-hmm. It's a necessity for people to have equity in order to live and do the things that they want to do.
Or even get to a doctor's appointment or use public transportation, you know?
Yeah, like that's not a convenience and that's not... It's crazy how they thought, like, how much less.
And why would it be temporary? Where
I don't know, because I think they just assumed that it would not hold up for many years and that it would just be like, oh, we'll do this for a few years and then people will forget about it because of all the outrage mm-hmm. that was currently happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they continue to do all these protests all over the world. They did a huge one at the Capitol building in 1990, which was deemed the Capitol crawl because all these people with disabilities and specifically people with wheelchairs and mobility aids got out of their wheelchairs at the stairs of the Capitol and climbed and crawled up the stairs, dragging their wheelchairs. This is another part where I almost cried in that documentary, because there was a little girl, probably 10 years old, crawling up these stairs. And like, it is just like they had to do this in order to show how much of a necessity a ramp is. Like, it's just a ramp. And there's another quote that I forget the person, I didn't have this prepared. There was an activist who was talking about how disabled people are used as inspiration. And like, oh, you're so strong, you're so powerful. Her quote is that no amount of smiling has ever made a staircase turn into a ramp.
It's a good quote. Yeah.
Being positive about your disability is not going to just magically make change happen. You have to advocate for yourself and fight for your change. So after that protest and the Capitol crawl, there was actually a senator, Ed Kennedy, introduced a bill that was called the Bill of Rights for the Disabled. And after a few months after this protest, George H.W. Bush, the president, signed the Americans with Disability Act into law. And that was like the major, that was like if you take the 504 and multiply it by like 100 times of importance for that.
I didn't realize that it was that recent that it was signed.
Yep. 1990.
I mean, excuse my ignorance, but it also just seems so crazy that it took that long to have something like this in place. Huh.
Yeah.
So pathetic.
Mm-hmm. It's the same with the civil rights movement. You think about
for sure. I
think that like my ignorance towards this is like a testament of how I believe that this should be taught, at least a little bit of this disability rights should be taught with the civil rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happening at the same time.
Yeah.
It has the same amount of shock. You're like, oh my God, this happened this recently.
Yeah.
Like with the civil rights. Like it's, I just feel like more people should know about this, because then I think it would, if you teach this in schools, then it usually makes people more accepting as they grow up and more understanding towards people with disabilities.
Yeah. I feel like the things that we all want and yearn for and try to achieve are so much more than the simple things that just recently weren't so commonplace.
Yeah.
And that's really scary.
Yeah. And I think like you hear that a lot of nowadays, you hear the term DEI.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people do not like.
Mm.
But because they're fundamentally misunderstanding what it truly means, because they actually think the E stands for equality when it means equity, which means it doesn't mean giving everybody the handouts and giving everybody the same. It means making sure that everybody has the same tools to reach the same opportunities.
Right.
Like that's equity is giving somebody a wheelchair who can't walk. Mm-hmm. Like it's not handing them a free job. It's ensuring that they, if they're qualified and they have this dream, that they can reach that despite their limitations.
You have done such a great job presenting so much of what you've learned in this class.
Yeah, it's just like something I'm so passionate about. And I mean, I'm like nowadays, I feel like disabled people are often like the butt end of a joke, and it's always the people without disabilities that are laughing at these jokes. And I'm just like, it's not that funny, because you don't know what these people go through. And I think my obligation as someone who's gone through a lot of trauma and is still able to be here and talk about it is to speak up as much as I can.
Well, I think you're doing a really good job. I know that you and your parents have been true advocates for you and your health, and you've been able to receive a variety of accommodations that have had a really big impact on your life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think people are aware of all that is offered?
I think to an extent, like you said, my parents were very involved and proactive about every aspect of how my disability would affect my life. They set up accommodations for me before I could even like pronounce the word or spell it, because I had accommodations in preschool and kindergarten. And like, I recognize that this is not the case for everyone. So I think I'm very lucky to have people that supported me through that process. And yeah, like I benefited a lot with accommodations throughout elementary school, high school, college, now even in the workplace, which I think a lot of people, I recently saw a video where this teacher was like, oh, 504 and accommodations don't exist in the real world. Like they think that it's just something in high school and then it just goes away. Or I think they even said in college too. I'm like, you get accommodations in college. In school, I had a one-on-one aide. I had a wheelchair. I had break times, extended test limits, because with my energy disorder, my hands would get tired. And before everything was on computers, I could not write big essays on paper. And I kept some of those same accommodations in college with, I think, extra time on tasks was the only one that I ever used, because I did college online, so I didn't have to worry about a wheelchair. And in the workplace, that was a major concern, because I never had a job before. And I went in with a doctor. The pre-employment health form was very interesting, because it was like, list any medications you have, or list, circle any conditions that you have. And if yeah, answered yes to any of them, explain. And it's just like a little tiny spot.
Right, you didn't give me enough room.
Because I answered yes on any of them, I had to actually sit down with a doctor, like a employee health doctor, and they had to make sure that I was actually able to do. They had like the list of the job requirements, the physical requirements, mm-hmm. and mental requirements. So I had to sit down and do that, and I explained to them what my limitations were. I asked multiple times if I was going to be just in one spot, because I was familiar with the lab. I did my clinicals there, so I knew what it was like, and I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't accepting a job. It's like, you're gonna have to walk up and down to the hospital and go to the ER and back. But they were really accommodating. They made sure, they even said if anything happened, they have ADA compliance nurse.
Oh, wow.
Who's extremely well versed on how they can make you ADA compliant and all this stuff. And this is something interesting too, because the ADA makes it so that you cannot get fired because of your disability, and they cannot take your disability. It's interesting. They cannot refuse you a job solely based on your disability. If you are extremely qualified and somebody with your same exact qualifications and your interview was perfect, if they accept somebody that has the same exact stuff as you but has a disability, they can't do that, because that means they're solely refusing you based on that disability. And they have to provide what the ADA defines as reasonable accommodations, meaning that they won't have to spend an immense amount of money to accommodate you. But if it's reasonable and they determine that, they have to provide you with accommodations. So like, if you needed an extra break time, I think they can support that. And a lot of people don't feel comfortable with disclosing their disability to a yeah. workplace, and I completely understand that. But I believe if it affects how you can complete your job, and you don't think that you can complete your requirements without accommodations, I feel that it's important to make them aware, because in my experience, they've been very accommodating and understanding of what I can and can't do. So they've been understanding that I can take breaks when I need them. They've never been hesitant towards that. I have a flexible schedule, which is really nice for when I have doctor's appointments. Mm-hmm. I recently had one, and I was like, oh, I emailed my boss. I was like, I'm sorry for changing all these dates, but I feel like all the dates that I choose are the ones that I have appointments on for some reason. And she's like, oh, never apologize for that. So it's just so
reassuring. It has to be so relieving. Yeah.
Yeah.
That you're in this position of really being understood and seen.
Yep.
Do you feel like, I guess more so growing up, right now it sounds like within your work, they are very much understanding and ready to make accommodations. But if I were to ask you or your parents, do you feel like a majority of the accommodations were ready to be secured, or did you really have to pave the way?
I think that I'm lucky in the sense that most of them have been very easy to achieve for us. We live in New York, which is usually a more accepting state, an understanding state. And even though like upstate New York gets a bad rep with stuff, the school district was very supportive, very, like I said in my other episode that I did with you, that they bought me a wheelchair to use at school. Like
that's so unique.
Yeah, like I just, whenever somebody's like explains the struggles they've had, like I say like, oh, I can understand that, but that's hasn't been my experience.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky to say that. But yeah, I think people know some of the accommodations, but I think it's important to research your own state, your own workplace or school district and see what they offer. Because even if you, like, I had accommodations that I never used, but it was like being overprepared in case something happened.
For sure.
So, like, I feel like you should take advantage of anything that they offer you, even if you don't think you're going to use it. And that was something I didn't like at school, because I felt I was really like resilient to use accommodations, because I thought it would mean that I'm like kind of cheating or like I'm giving special treatment. But I think like it, my case, like it shows that they do work, and if you have them, you should be able to use them.
I'm sure on some days too, you felt like you really did need them, and on other days, it probably didn't feel quite as appropriate. I don't know exactly how you feel on a daily basis, but I know for me, there's some days where I feel like I could keep up with my contemporaries, and other days where I feel much, much, much different. Right?
Yeah. That was definitely like my experience growing up. Like, there's some days where I'm like, I'm going to do everything I can today. And there's others like, I can't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you talk about like the cultural acceptance and like the social acceptance of those with disabilities within your class, did your professor and does the class feel like there really have been big strides in like social acceptance?
From what I've seen, because a lot of online colleges, they do discussion posts. So you get to see what all these...
Oh, yeah.
You get to see what all these other classmates are thinking.
Yeah.
And I think there's been so much societal change. I mean, there's still the struggles. There's still, even though it's considered illegal, there is so many lawsuits filed because of disability discrimination in the workplace. But I feel as though there's been so many more resources than there were even 10, 20 years ago. So many more people that are willing to help than there were. And I just think the overall society has like exponentially changed since the ADA and since people were awoken to the experiences of people with disability.
Thank you for sharing this experience that you've had in class with us. Again, this was your idea to come on and to share with us. And I'm so glad you did, because, I mean, I've learned a lot. I guarantee you everybody listening out there has learned something from this episode. And I think the recent nature of all the changes has been a huge wow factor for me. And I'm glad that there are classes that focus on this. I would love to take part in something like this.
Yeah, it's been a great experience. And I think I've seen with the other classmates, they share that it's crazy how even like a little experience with somebody, like I remember a classmate saying they were best friends with somebody with a disability in high school, and like somebody from the special ed classes. I think like even little experiences like that really shape the way you view people with disabilities and how that can affect how you learn through a class like this.
Totally, totally. Well, Matthew, please continue bringing us good ideas. You are always welcome to share with us on the podcast. I really enjoy having you on. Thank you for sharing with us and for spending your energy today recording with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.